conforming to the usual model. I would have thought that by now he would have begun to devolve, become more chaotic, even sloppy. Think of the dramatic mood swings he exhibited just before the police almost caught him that last time. I would have put money on them escalating, but he seems even more controlled than before.
I wonder, said Sam, if he uses the periods between his killing episodes to step out of himself completely and become a different person for a while. Adopting another persona might enable him to regroup in some way.
Laura nodded slowly. We know he had various existences before. In most of them, he was a charitable, altruistic person. People who knew him at those times loved and admired him. He even passed himself off as a psychological counselor at one point, I seem to remember.
From what we know from his file, that's how he rolls. I think he likes to be in the company of needy, damaged, vulnerable people, mused Sam. And becomes their support and mentor. And he revels in the adoration they show him.
All of that would support his self-belief and make him stronger. Unwittingly, they are feeding his psychosis. Then, when he is recharged, he starts killing again. God!
If he wasn't so dangerous, I'd admire his patience, Sam grimaced. But as it is, he just scares me.
You aren't alone, Sam. I keep remembering that he promised to meet me in person. The thought terrifies me.
I haven't forgotten, my dear young friend. And it's one reason I'm here. You shouldn't be wandering around alone, should you? Sam said sternly. There are police patrolling the hospital, but they can't watch everyone. I know you can't let Ashcroft rule your life, but as you said yourself, he marked your card. Even if it was just an empty threat, you have to take it seriously. Laura felt a rush of affection for her old friend. She slipped her arm through his.
I can't think about that too deeply, Sam, or I'd never step out of the door. I won't let that monster imprison me. If he preys on weakness, then I'm damned if I'm going to be weak.
Just be careful. Discretion and all that. Sam patted her hand. You are a precious commodity, Laura Archer, and I'm not the only one who thinks so.
There was a silence for a moment or two. I cannot begin to understand what Jackman is going through at present, Laura said. I don't mean just worrying over me, it's everything. His old nemesis, Ashcroft, another maniac with a gun who has now turned to killing police officers. Everyone he loves or cares about under threat, and the responsibility for a town's safety, all on his shoulders. How long can he keep this up, Sam?
He turned to her and said, I believe he will, Laura, until Ashcroft and his hired gun are safely behind bars, or in the morgue. His adrenaline is pumping and he's in fight mode. He'll see this through, I know it. It's the aftermath that worries me, but we'll deal with that when the time comes.
And that nightmare? I know it still bothers him.
Let's hope that with everything else he has to deal with, the memory of that dream will fade. He's not a fanciful man, is he? Jackman doesn't believe in omens and portents. It was simply terrifyingly real, and it was about Marie and the man who killed his sister-in-law, so obviously it will have affected him. That's totally understandable.
Sam sounded so certain that Laura felt her spirits lift. She recalled how Jackman suddenly seemed to change. It was as if he had shifted his whole game and brought a different attitude to bear on the situation. She said as much to Sam.
You know as well as I do that he's developed a coping mechanism and it's working.
Sam smiled.
Now, young lady, are you going to do as Uncle Sam says and not go dashing off alone any more?
She nodded. I'll be careful, I promise.
That's not quite the same thing.
He looked at her over the rim of his spectacles. No, I mean it, Sam. I won't underestimate Ashcroft's threat, but life has to go on.
Just remember, it's the only one you have. Don't throw it away. He stood up. Right. Sermon over. Let's get back to Kevin, eh?
Chapter 24. This was truly hilarious.
A mess room full of strapping macho blokes, all spraying expensive men's cologne on their wrists and discussing it with utter seriousness. Priceless. Robbie wished he had the courage to video it on his smartphone. Once the room was reeking of terrible Teddy, Robbie took the precious bottle and walked through to control, where he treated all the officers there to a whiff. It took around half an hour to seek out most of the men and women who were likely to be out on the streets and have a chance of crossing Ashcroft's path. He even sprayed a little onto a handkerchief and allowed the dog handler to offer it to his canine partner. The German Shepherd merely coughed, unimpressed. He returned to the CID room, sat down at his desk, and stared at the distinctive bottle. Smaller things than this had led to the capture of criminals in the past. One thing was for sure. When this case was finally over, he never wanted to smell that perfume again. Charlie Button called out to him from the other side of the office.
"Boss wants us in his office, mate. He said to bring a chair and your notebook."
Robbie picked up his notepad and took his chair to Jackman's office. Marie and Gary were already there, and Charlie and Rosie were gathering up chairs. What was this all about? As soon as everyone was seated, Jackman began. "Ruth, Crook, and I agree that there is little point in us wasting time trying to track the sniper. We already have highly trained uniformed officers out there asking questions and following up leads so they can carry on. We are going to do what we set out to do in the first place, hunt for Alistair Ashcroft." He picked up a sheet of paper. "To this end, I've had Rosie trawl through the last investigation and pull out any addresses or locations that he was connected to, even slightly, and list them. We'll work in pairs and visit each place, then widen the search to anywhere else that might be connected or in some way attractive to him. We'll go armed with a new set of photos that Orac has produced in IT. She has aged him slightly and made subtle changes in each picture, in the hopes that even if he's disguised, one of them may bear some resemblance to his real self. We'll talk to anyone who will listen and show them the pictures." Robbie was relieved that they were going to be doing something concrete, even if it did remind him of being back in uniform and doing house-to-house inquiries. Robbie was determined to be the one to find Ashcroft. The man had made a fool of him, and Robbie Melton couldn't be doing with that. "To start with, we'll tackle the estate agent who handled the properties Ashcroft got rid of around a year ago. He may have been back since, either buying or selling, or renting, of course. If that fails, as I suspect it will, we'll try all the other estate agents and letting companies in Salton and the surrounding area. He has to have a base. You take that, Gary and Rosie." He stared at the list again. "Robbie and Charlie, I want you to check out his old solicitor, paying particular attention to the properties that were in his possession, just in case he didn't sell them all before he disappeared. There was also a woman who had business dealings with him pertaining to the sale of his properties. Her name was Philippa or Pip Courtney. Ashcroft deceived her badly, and I doubt that she now harbours the fond feelings that she had for him then, but she saw a lot of him. She would recognise him if she saw him, I'm certain of that."
"And me, boss?" asked Marie.
"We are going to church."
"To confess our sins?"
Marie grinned at him.
"Could do that as well if you like, but no. To see if Ashcroft has made an appearance in any of them. If you remember, last time he used a lot of biblical quotes and references, and we deduced that he liked to frequent churches. He was also known to attend meetings and volunteer for charity work, all church-based. Maybe he's trying something like that now."
"It's a good cover, hiding under the petticoats of religious do-gooders. He's got such a silver tongue, he'd have them all eating out of his hand in no time," Marie scowled.
"Exactly," Robbie said somewhat bitterly. "You only have to think how he deceived the Lorimer family, and us, to know how damn good he is. And let's not forget that missing motorbike, the one he got away from Hawker's Fen on. Did he ditch it, store it somewhere, give it away, or sell it? Eyes and ears open, guys," Jackman said.
They were just about to leave when Jackman stopped them. He looked at Rosie, smiled, and said,
There is one other thing that you should know. Listening, Robbie wasn't surprised to hear that Rosie was leaving. He'd been amazed at how she and Max had coped thus far. It was a sensible decision, but he would miss her a lot. He'd always admired her dogged tenacity. Like a terrier, she never let anything go. They all crowded around, wishing her well. There were hugs, tears were shed. Then Jackman told them that they would have a proper send-off later, but right now they were too busy chasing a certain psychopath. Robbie looked across to Charlie.
Ready?
Charlie nodded.
Ready.
And I want you wearing Kevlar vests whenever you are out on the streets, Jackman added. Ruth has arranged for CID officers as well as uniformed officers to have these for the duration of this situation. They are stab and ballistic resistant, but only to handgun standard. They won't stop a sniper's bullet, I'm afraid. But we know our assassin uses a handgun too, so it's worth wearing one, okay?
Oh, hell, I hate those things,
Marie muttered. Think yourself lucky you aren't having to wear the heavier kit, you know? The one the armed response units and the firearms officers have to use. And no excuses, Marie Evans. You, of all people, should protect yourself as much as possible. After all, you and I are at the top of his list, aren't we?
Pulling a face, Marie reluctantly agreed.
We've only got an hour and a half before the 4 o'clock meeting, so do what you can this afternoon and crack straight on in the morning, okay?
They all nodded, gathered up their chairs and left the office.
Back in the CID room, Robbie took Rosie aside.
You don't have to go out this afternoon, you know. Jackman will understand. These are your last few hours here. Do you want to spend them traipsing around estate agents knowing there's a sniper on the loose? You could make a whole lot of inquiries by phone.
She smiled at him. Thanks for caring, Robbie. But until I hand over my warrant card, I'm a police officer. And why the hell would I want to stay here on my own while you lot are having fun hunting killers?
He threw up his hands. I give in. Just be careful, okay?
He'd done his best to dissuade her, feeling he owed it to Max. But Rosie was clearly having none of it.
Let's go and grab one of those new vests then, shall we? He said.
Gary could not believe the change that had come over the town. Sultan Le Fen was no metropolis, being smaller even than Greenborough, but it was a bustling market town, whose twice-weekly farmers' market attracted locals and visitors alike. Now it was practically deserted, and the few shoppers who were out hurried along the streets, heads down, keeping close to the shop fronts.
This is weird, whispered Rosie.
Ruth Crook's warning has hit home, I'd say. Gary looked around. There are more police on the streets than civilians.
Can't blame them, I must say.
She checked her list for the address of the first estate agent.
No one knows where or when the gunman will strike again.
Not sure he'd agree with you. Gary indicated to a man, clearly drunk, staggering around the deserted market square, shouting,
You want me? Come and fucking get me, asshole. Hiding in the fucking shadows, bloody coward.
Before Gary even had a chance to move, two uniformed officers materialized from nowhere and escorted him away.
He's got a point, muttered Rosie. It is a cowardly thing to do, shoot someone.
They walked on.
That's something that bothers me about all this. Think back to the horrific scenarios, the slow, terrible deaths that Ashcroft's evil mind concocted for his original victims. Why has he changed his M.O. so radically this time around and hired a shooter?
Gary thought about this.
Maybe it's because last time he was enacting just retribution as he saw it. Now it's a vendetta against the police. Well, the boss and the Sarge, to be exact. So execution-style deaths are more appropriate, and for that you need an expert. I just find it hard to equate such an impersonal method with Alistair Ashcroft.
Gary shrugged.
Well, we know he likes guns. After all, he did shoot Jackman and tried to shoot Marie, didn't he?
True. And maybe he likes the power of sending out a minion to kill in his name.
Rosie stopped and double-checked the list.
Milgate and Forshaw. Let's talk to them.
It didn't take long to realize that they were wasting their time.
The manager was more concerned that the spate of murders would bring house prices down and affect his business.
Consolations. That's all I've had. No one wants to go viewing houses in a town that's being terrorised. In 2 years, Salton will be a ghost town, you mark my words.
Rosie had showed him the photographs of Ashcroft in his many possible guises, but Milgate just shook his head.
I've had no one that looks even vaguely like that in here.
He passed the pictures to two rather miserable-looking young men who agreed that they hadn't seen him either. They gave up. Outside, Gary said,
"Have a feeling this is a taste of things to come. Who's next?"
"The new one down Galleon Alley. Galleon Homes? They're relatively new, and as far as I can remember, they mainly do long-term lets." Rosie led the way down a narrow, cobbled lane with shops on either side. At least this time they were greeted with an expectant smile, a definite improvement on Milgate. Introducing himself and Rosie, Gary learned that the agent was called Ronnie Beasley, and he was pretty much a one-man band. With just one assistant, who was out doing a valuation, he handled most of the transactions personally.
"Can't be too negative about this situation, can we?" said Beasley. "Things have a habit of flaring up and then dying down and becoming yesterday's news. People will always want houses or places to rent."
Gary commended his positive attitude.
"Any chance this man has been in here, sir, possibly wanting to rent somewhere?"
Beasley stared at the pictures, before pausing at one of Orak's computer-generated likenesses.
"There's something about this one that rings bells."
Gary held his breath. He felt Rosie tense beside him.
"He may not look exactly like that. These are just approximations," said Gary hopefully. "Do you think you've seen him?"
Beasley frowned.
"Yes, about 6 weeks, 2 months ago. A man who looked something like this came in looking for a property to rent. I remember he was very particular about his requirements and money didn't seem to be a concern. Sadly, I didn't have anything that suited him."
"Sir," Rosie leaned forward, "how did he differ from this picture? Could you describe him for us?"
"He had very short hair. I think they call it a fade. Fuller on top, then fades to a close cut back and sides. It was a sandy blonde colour. I thought then that it was really a cut for a younger man, but still it suited him."
He gave them a slightly apologetic smile.
"I notice these kind of things because my wife's a men's hairdresser." "Height and age, at a guess?"
asked Gary.
"About my height, but age, I'm not good with ages."
Beasley paused.
"Possibly in his 40s. Casually dressed, but he had that look of money about him, if you know what I mean."
Rosie took a handkerchief from her pocket. "This is a long shot, sir. I don't suppose you remember if he was wearing a fragrance that smelt like this." Beasley looked apologetic.
"There I can't help you, officers. I have no sense of smell."
Gary swore under his breath.
"Just our luck.
We get a possible ID, a guy who was up close and personal with our mark, but he can't smell anything."
"If it helps, he looked the kind of man to wear something classy, even if it was just to go to the golf club for drinks."
"Or the gun club."
"Would you have his name on record, sir?"
Gary said.
"And a contact number?" "I'll look for you. But when we had exhausted all the houses I had on my books, he told me not to worry. He'd have to look elsewhere. He did say he'd call in again at a later date, should he be unlucky and need to rethink his criteria."
Beasley went to a filing cabinet and thumbed through a series of folders.
Well, I made a note of his name and what he required, but there's no number, I'm afraid."
He returned to the desk and handed Gary a sheet of paper.
"Richard Reeves,"
Gary murmured.
"Right."
He skimmed through the list.
"He was very specific, wasn't he, sir? Detached property, double garage, 3 bedrooms, quiet location, with no near neighbours, and within a 5-mile radius of the town centre." "That's right, officers. He said he would be alone here for a while, then his family would be joining him a little later. He said they had dogs, and he didn't want close neighbours in case the animals disturbed anyone."
Beasley frowned.
"Can I see those pictures again, please?"
Rosie handed them to him.
Yes, that's definitely him. It's just the hair that's different. The thing that gives him away are the eyes.
He thumbed through the other pictures.
It's the same with all of these photos. You can change everything about that face to make it look different, but apart from changing the iris colour, you can't alter those eyes. They are oddly almond-shaped. I thought it was unusual at the time.
Gary stared at them. Beasley was right. Then he recalled a snippet of information about Alistair Ashcroft from the original case. The special school that he had attended had suspected him of suffering from a genetic disorder called Fragile X syndrome, something that often shows itself in a long, narrow face with large ears and almond-shaped eyes. Alistair had not exhibited all those physical differences, but his eyes were large and almond-shaped. He shivered. Ashcroft had been right here, looking for a new lair.
"Can we take this list, sir? You can rest assured he won't be back."
"Please do.
And I must say, I'm afraid to ask why you want to find him."
Beasley looked at them anxiously. Rosie flashed him a reassuring smile.
"We just need to talk to him about an ongoing investigation, sir, that's all."
But Beasley wasn't to be reassured so easily.
"Has he got something to do with this gunman?"
Gary intervened.
"Please don't worry about it, sir. We just think he might be able to help with another case we're working on. Tell me, what was your impression of him?"
"Bit of a toff. Well off, well spoken, obviously well educated. Had a sense of humour, as I recall, but was rather intense and very picky about what sort of property he was looking for."
Gary nodded.
"Well, thank you for your time, sir. You've been most helpful."
He handed him a card.
"And should you see him again, please ring us immediately."
Beasley nodded.
"I hope you find him, officers."
As they left, Gary saw him quickly flip the sign of the door to closed. Beasley wasn't taking any chances.
"Now we know the kind of property he was looking for, we can see if any of the other agents had a similar request," Rosie said.
For a moment she looked excited, then her face fell.
"Well, you can.
We'll never get around all of them before the shift ends or they close, and then, well, it's all over for me."
"And I'm very glad it is, Rosie. Time for you to be a mum and not miss those precious early years, and don't worry about us. We'll catch the bugger for you."
"You better."
She took a slow breath.
"And look out for my Max, won't you, Gary? Until this is over, I'll worry myself sick every time he goes out of the door."
"Of course I will."
Gary was serious now.
"We all will. This team is special. We look out for each other, you know that."
Rosie looked as if she was about to cry again. Then she sniffed and said,
"Okay, Gazza,
let's check that big letting agent just off the market square. With what Beasley told us, we have a better chance now."
"Lead on."
Chapter 25.
"I had no idea there were so many churches in Salton," said Marie.
She had already ticked off 3 non-starters from Rosie's list.
"Next one is the Church of Our Lady of Sorrows. It's Catholic, isn't it?"
"The biggest and most ornate. I can see something like that appealing to his overinflated ego, can't you?"
Jackman said.
"And it's only a few minutes' walk from here."
Marie kept looking around her, constantly checking the tops of buildings, upstairs windows, flat roofs, any place that a sniper might choose to conceal himself.
It was a strange feeling,
knowing that at any given moment you could be in the crosshairs of a rifle sight. She'd had stark confirmation of how fast things could happen when she saw Ernie Teal sitting in the police car, dead. One second he was considering a nice chocolate bar, the next he was gone. In the time it had taken for a windshield to shatter, a life had shattered too. Jackman glanced at her.
"You okay, Marie?"
"As good as I can be. Knowing a killer is out there and both our names are on his to-do list."
She turned to him.
"But I have no intention of hiding under my office desk until this is over, so I'll bloody well take my chances."
Jackman chuckled.
"Spoken like a true Evans."
So, how are we going to tackle this lot of Bible bashers?
With tact, if you can recall what that is, Sergeant.
He was still smiling when his mobile rang.
Jackman.
Murray waited. From Jackman's expression, it obviously wasn't another death. She looked at him inquiringly.
Gary, he says to check out photo number 4. They've had a positive ID on a man who resembles that one, but with shorter, sandy-coloured hair.
Brilliant. That's a step forward. But hang on a minute. Suppose he changed his appearance for every estate agent.
Gary also said the witness referred to the eyes. They are quite distinctive.
Marie remembered those eyes vividly. They had stared into hers, full of hate and loathing. She swallowed. They are, aren't they? I wonder why neither Robbie nor Charlie noticed that when they spoke to Ezra.
They weren't expecting anyone other than Rachel Lorimer's cousin. There was no earthly reason to think the man they spoke to was anyone other than who he claimed to be. Plus, I swear, even I wouldn't have recognized him in the clever makeup and that old facial scar with the wig and beard, and I've met him face to face, unfortunately.
Jackman grimaced.
At least we know how he is working. The doors to the big church stood open. Larger than the others, Marie found it rather austere. Their footsteps echoed on the flagstones. Other than an old couple sitting close together in the lady chapel, the place seemed empty. They looked around, hopefully.
Father Malone is in the vestry,
the woman said.
Jackman thanked her and led the way towards a door to the left of the chancel. The layout was different from the church she had attended as a girl. The Methodist chapel had been plain and simple. This one seemed designed to impress. Jackman knocked on the vestry door.
Come.
Father Malone was a tall, heavy man with a balding head, surrounded by a halo of curly ginger hair that grew to meet a tight ginger beard.
Come in, come in. How can I help you two lovely people?
Jackman held up his warrant card, as did Marie.
Oh, no, Brendan's not in trouble again, is he?
A cloud spread over his face.
That boy. What is it this time? Petty theft again? I did say I didn't want to press charges, but...
No, sir.
Jackman stopped the flow.
We've come to talk to you about a quite different matter.
The priest pointed to 2 hard chairs.
Then please sit.
Jackman explained who they were looking for and asked if anyone new had started visiting the church recently, possibly someone who'd expressed interest in helping with charitable activities.
He's well-educated, Father, and quite charismatic.
No, detectives, I can't say I've seen anyone like that. There have been very few new worshippers of late.
Marie showed him the photographs, although she didn't believe they would be of any help. The priest looked through them and handed them back.
I can't say I've ever seen this man, I'm sorry.
Jackman gave him his card and a copy of one of the original pictures of Ashcroft. He asked the priest to hang on to it, and if he ever saw the man, to ring him immediately.
I wish I could have helped you, detectives. But only one man has been kind enough to offer his help in the past few months. He doesn't look like that, and I wouldn't say he's charismatic at all.
He gave a little laugh.
Far from it. He's quite taciturn, in fact.
Jackman's eyes narrowed.
What does he look like, Father? Working-class man? Bit rough around the edges. Though he does have strong opinions about things, so maybe I'm wrong in thinking he's not educated.
How long has he been coming here?
Asked Marie.
Only a week or two, and not regularly. His name is David.
What does he look like, Father? As in hair colour, for instance. Jackman looked edgy.
He always wears a hat, so I can't tell you about his hair. But his clothes are pretty well worn, almost scruffy. It took a while to get him to talk, but he's a very kind man at heart.
A hat? In church? Commented Jackman.
Not everyone conforms to tradition, detective.
and in these days of diminishing congregations, I welcome them with open arms no matter what they are wearing. Marie took the photos from Jackman and selected the fourth.
You're sure nothing about this likeness reminds you of David? Take another look, Father. Take each feature in turn and look really hard.
The priest covered part of the face with his hand and stared at the picture. The silence was palpable. Finally, he gave a little sniff.
Funnily enough, there is something about those dark eyes. David has very dark eyes.
Glancing quickly at her, Jackman said,
When did you see him last, Father?
Father Malone looked at his watch.
About 4 hours ago.
Here,
Marie exclaimed.
Well, yes, where else?
The priest looked puzzled.
He comes to pray.
Oh, right. Of course.
Pray for whom, exactly? For Ernie Teal? For Kevin Stoner, maybe?
Marie almost snorted in disgust.
What do you know about this, David? Asked Jackman. Anything at all you can think of?
Father Malone lifted his hands in resignation.
Very little, Detective. I'm here to listen. I don't pry into people's lives and rarely ask questions unless it's about someone's faith.
So he's told you nothing about his personal life?
Marie said.
If he did, I couldn't tell you. Surely you know that.
His expression was reproachful.
We're not talking about the confession, Father, just day-to-day chat, things he might tell anyone,
Jackman said. The priest looked thoughtful.
He told me he had no family in Salton, which made me think he was taking advantage of the seasonal work around here. But then his hands were smooth and clean. They looked too soft for a manual worker. He did say he was a very private man and that being in this church calmed all the thoughts that sometimes threatened to overwhelm him.
He frowned.
This is purely supposition, but I wouldn't be surprised if he suffers from some kind of mental illness.
It was all Marie could do not to explode. If only this man knew the extent of Ashcroft's psychological problems. Coolly, Jackman said,
What makes you think that?
I felt that deep inside he was harboring a terrible anger. Talking to him, you could sometimes sense it bubbling up and calming again. And he is careful about what he says. I've seen that before in people who are grieving and don't know how to handle the mood swings. Maybe he'll tell me one day.
And maybe he won't.
Marie said, Father, do you happen to have CCTV here?
Only at the front door. We had a young tearaway get in with a spray can a while back. I had to get a professional company in to clean up after him.
And how many doors are there here?
She asked.
Apart from the main door, there's the south aisle door and the vestry door, which leads to my house.
Does David use one of those?
Actually, no. He comes in the main entrance.
Jackman's look seemed to say, Could we be that lucky? She nodded.
Father, we need to see this morning's footage.
The priest went to a cupboard in the corner of the room. Inside was a small wireless CCTV monitor.
Gift from one of our more generous parishioners. I can view everything from my mobile phone if I wish.
He picked up a mouse and began scrolling through that morning's footage.
Ah, got it.
He stood back to let them see a figure approaching the main door. The man had dark, rather scruffy clothes, heavy trainers, and was wearing a baggy brown driver's cap. Marie would never have believed that this could be Ashcroft, until he glanced up and looked directly at the camera. Marie watched while an insidious, knowing smile passed across his face and was gone. Suddenly she could smell petrol, blood, and incense. Without a doubt, David was Alistair Ashcroft, and he had sat quietly in this church while his hired gun robbed PC Ernie Teal of his life. For a moment, Marie thought she was going to be sick.
Jackman touched her arm.
You okay?
Swallowing bile, she struggled to collect herself, vaguely aware of the priest staring at her.
Yeah, just give me a moment.
Jackman was speaking to him.
Father, we believe that David is really Alistair Ashcroft, a wanted man. He is a very dangerous killer, and we have to find him.
The priest bowed his head, crossed himself and murmured a few words under his breath. He looked up.
But he offered to help me with a new meeting group, somewhere those who are troubled can come and talk about their problems. You say he's a murderer, but why would such a man offer to help with charitable work?
I'm afraid he's done this before, Father. He makes himself out to be a saint with a listening ear, and vulnerable people love him, but all the time he's gloating over their misery. Father, he's evil. Jackman's voice was hard.
That's a very strong word, Detective. It's generally reserved for the Antichrist.
This man caused the death of a close family member. Jackman sounded angry now. I know what I'm talking about. Marie looked at him in surprise.
I'm sorry, Father. That was wrong of me. Nevertheless, I cannot emphasize strongly enough just how dangerous this man is.
Now, did he say when he would be back?
Friday at 10 to help me prepare for the meeting. Other than that, he has no strict schedule. He comes and goes.
That was days away. They couldn't just wait around until then. There will be police watching the church from now on, Father. Marie was back on track. Naturally, if we haven't caught him, we will be waiting for him on Friday morning, but we need to find him way sooner than that, and we'll need access to that CCTV footage. Is that okay with you?
Of course. I'll give you the password, and to make it easier, you can download an app that lets you view it remotely.
There was nothing more the priest could tell them. So after leaving their cards, along with instructions on what to do if he should turn up again, they hastened back to the station. As they walked, Jackman barked orders into his phone. He wanted Our Lady of Sorrows placed under round-the-clock surveillance. This was a recent sighting, the closest they had been to Ashcroft other than in his guise of Ezra Lorimer. So he was definitely based locally. Now, if Gary and Rosie could just get a bite from one of the estate agents... Marie quickened her pace. Rachel Lorimer was still angry. But now she was angry at herself for having been taken in, and furious at the man who had killed her cousin. Although they didn't see each other, over the years, she and Ezra had maintained their bond. Yes, he had been a bit of a rogue, but he was kind to her. Now he was dead, her family in tatters. Of all her children, only Jacob seemed to accept what had happened, but even he was downcast, grieving for his lost horse. Esther had locked herself in her caravan and refused to come out. Noah was in a deep depression, fantasizing about being thrown into some police dungeon and never released. Levi was terrified that their actions would result in a criminal charge and that his job would be in jeopardy. And Paul, well, Paul had driven off after the police left and they hadn't seen him since. Now as evening approached, Rachel began to wonder where he had gone. He wasn't stable at the best of times, but an upset such as this could result in serious problems. He had a terrible temper, and although he had never actually hurt anyone, she feared that one day, pushed too far, he could be a danger to himself and others. She stood at the kitchen sink, peeling potatoes and staring out of the window, looking for signs of Paul's return. Gillian, Levi's wife, sat at the pine table slicing runner beans. Today Rachel had seen a different side to their meek Gillian, and she looked at the girl with a new respect. Levi needed support. Levi entered, laid a dead rabbit on the table and said,
"Want me to skin it, Ma? It's a plump little devil, like a tasty pie." "Later, boy. Go hang it in the root store and try not to let Jacob see. You know how it upsets him. Right now, I've got another job for you."
Rachel watched him hurry off. She suspected she would get little backchat from any of her family for a while. When he was back, she asked if he knew where Paul was.
No lies now. That's all finished and done with. Just give me a straight answer.
He looked her in the eyes. No, ma, I don't. She accepted his words. She knew when the boys were lying, and now Levi was being straight with her.
All right, go and get the others and bring them here, and no refusals, especially from Esther.
Again he scuttled off, and Rachel felt a surge of love for her poor family of overgrown children. Despite the risks involved in bearing so many, Rachel had done what her husband wanted and given him a big family. But he had died, and she was left to carry the burden. One by one they drifted in and sat down at the table. Rachel pointed at the one empty chair.
Do any of you have the slightest idea where Paul might be?
They all shook their heads. Then Jacob raised his hand hesitantly.
Do you know where he is, son?
I think he's looking for the man who killed Uncle Ezra, and who lied to us.
Rachel sighed. The thought had crossed her mind as well.
Does Paul know where that man might be?
Jacob screwed up his face.
I don't know, but when he does find him, he'll kill him. I heard him say that just before he drove off.
He smiled at his mother.
That's good, isn't it?
She closed her eyes.
No, son. You can't just kill people, even if they are bad. The law has to deal with them. Paul might get himself into trouble.
Oh,
said Jacob, sounding disappointed. It seemed he couldn't stand to see an animal killed, but wiping out the man who had deceived them was something else.
Shame.
Now Rachel was worried.
Levi, you have to find Paul and stop him.
Levi, who had been slouching over the table, drew himself up.
Yes, ma, but where do I look?
You know your brother better than any of us. You know where he goes, who he meets. Just look for him.
I'll go with you.
Gillian put down her paring knife and stood up.
Two sets of eyes are better than one.
Rachel saw a look of admiration and relief on Levi's face.
Is that okay, ma?
She nodded.
Just bring him home.
She paused.
And son, be careful, and watch that woman of yours, all right? The town is not a good place to be right now.
Jacob stood up.
I'll go too, ma. Levi might need me.
They all looked at the youngest Lorimer in amazement. It was the first time in many years that he had even acknowledged Levi's existence. For his part, Levi seemed ready to burst into tears.
Can Jacob come too?
Rachel smiled at her sons.
I'm sorry, Levi. I know he would be a great help to you, but night is falling and I really need him here to protect the rest of us. Do you understand, both of you?
Levi nodded. Jacob said,
I understand, ma, and don't worry. I will protect you all.
It was all Rachel could do not to cry. Were her two warring boys really talking again? Maybe some good would come out of this mess after all.
Chapter 26. Look, guys, we can't work 24/7.
Jackman surveyed the room. No one had gone home. They had had a brief catch-up and learnt that Robbie and Charlie had had no luck at all with the solicitor. There had been no contact of any kind from Ashcroft since the day he disappeared. All his transactions had been closed, all his properties disposed of, and all his monies moved out to an unknown destination. End of story.
I suggest you all get off home and be ready to start early tomorrow. We now have some leads and the net is closing in. We are restricting his movements and shutting off some of the places that he retreats to. We also have an up-to-date description and a CCTV shot of him. We are in a better position than before, so tomorrow we tighten the net further. And if all else fails, he has an appointment at the church on Friday.
He looked at each one of them in turn, trying to impress on them the seriousness of the threat Ashcroft posed.
Watch your backs. Stay vigilant every moment.
trust no one, and ring in at the slightest hint of something being wrong. Got it? There was a general murmur of agreement, and Gary said,
And the same goes for you, boss.
Jackman nodded. I'm not going to underestimate this man, believe me. Now, get home. He stopped, looked at Rosie, and don't worry, this is not goodbye. Once this horrible case is over, we'll give you the best send-off ever, I promise. Rosie smiled rather sadly.
I'll hold you to that, sir. Go careful, all of you. I couldn't bear it if...
Jackman held up his hand. You think of yourself and your little ones. And even though you won't be here, keep your policeman's head on, Rosie, and stay watchful. Treat everyone with caution until this psycho is locked up, understand?
I won't need telling twice, sir, believe me.
They all stood up. Each of them hugged Rosie, gathered up their things, and filed out. Jackman felt a rush of emotion. How lucky he was to have such a loyal team. He promised himself that they would come through this unscathed. He had to get Ashcroft before he got to them. Kenneth Harcourt had earned himself something of a name in the shooting world. His club, the Fenside, was considered one of the best in the region. Deciding to use that to his advantage, he rang the two biggest rival clubs, both of whom hosted sniper experience days. He had spoken to them before, trying to discover if Ralph Renwick had booked a place on a course in the last month or so. This time, he was asking for lists of all their members and the guests who had booked on those courses. He knew both owners pretty well and decided to tell them exactly why he was making this request. He and his club had been targeted, and he needed their help. The police would be making the same request, but friend to friend, he hoped that they would help him. Within half an hour, he had two lists giving the names of all the people who had taken part in the sniper days. Both clubs had strict membership requirements. No one with a criminal conviction could join, and everyone using the club's weapons had to produce a valid passport or driver's license. Those using their own guns had to supply shotgun and firearm certificates. Everything was photocopied and kept on file, including a photo. Harcourt had become obsessed with finding the man who had shot and killed first his friend Arthur, and now, at the entrance to his property, a police officer. He considered everything this killer did as a personal affront. To add insult to injury, he was using Harcourt's own gun to carry out his murderous attacks. He scanned the pictures eagerly, hoping for a glimpse of someone he recognized, particularly Ralph Renwick. No one seemed to fit the bill. Dejected, he tossed the papers onto his desk. Then he thought again and picked them up. They were of no use to him, but maybe there was a face on one of those lists that meant something to the police. Harcourt picked up the phone and rang the mobile number for the detective inspector called Jackman. Soon, Jackman was staring at the lists Kenneth Harcourt had sent. He had no idea what this Ralph Renwick looked like, but nevertheless he checked them carefully in case a face cropped up that was known to them. Many of the images were typical passport mugshots and far from clear. Then, on the last page, a face caught his attention. He realized that he hadn't been looking for Ashcroft. He had been looking for the shooter, using the estate agent's description. But the face staring out at Jackman was that of Alistair Ashcroft. He was sure of it. Ashcroft, in one of his many disguises. His mind went into overdrive. Ashcroft, on a sniper course? Jackman groaned out loud. Oh, sweet Lord. There was no deranged gunman. They had been looking for two killers when there was only one. He closed his eyes and put his head in his hands. What had the gunman said to Kevin? Tell him not to get sidetracked with his old adversary, because I'm just as dangerous. What was he saying? That he had changed, become a different kind of killer, a new adversary. Jackman exhaled. He needed to talk to Laura. He hurried downstairs to find the duty sergeant. He briefly told him he suspected that the shooter could be Ashcroft, then had him circulate the message.
He daredn't risk anyone underestimating the man they'd thought was a hired gun. Next, he made one of his very rare trips down to the basement to visit Orak, the High Priestess of the IT department. It was a standing joke that Orla Kraken, aka Orak, terrified Jackman. It wasn't so much her white blonde Mohican haircut, but the mirror contact lenses she wore that Jackman found so disturbing. He generally sent Marie to talk to her, but tonight it was down to him. He set his jaw and made for the stairs. He found Orak alone in her high-tech domain. He wondered if she ever went home. Did she even have one? Besides the fact that she lived and breathed computing, he also knew that she had a secret, something to do with her past, which she had once revealed to Marie. For once, Marie had refused to share it with him, saying she didn't betray confidences. So not only was Orak exceptionally brilliant, but she was mysterious too. "You must be in a rather desperate need, Detective Inspector Jackman, to risk venturing unaccompanied into my lair." Those metallic eyes betrayed nothing. But he knew she was teasing him.
"You know me so well, Orak. Yes, I do need your help."
He handed her the photo of the man he suspected to be Ashcroft.
"We believe we have a match for one of those likenesses you produced. Do you think you'd be able to play with this driving license photo and see if it's the same man?" "Of course. Would you like me to ring your mobile tonight when I have something for you?" "If it's not too much trouble," he said politely. "Oh, anything for you, Inspector."
She did it every time. Orak had made him blush. No matter how hard he tried to act the professional, he always finished up like a tongue-tied schoolboy. He murmured another thank you and scuttled away, calling himself names as he went. Outside the building, he rang Marie.
"I'm on my way to meet Laura, so she can give me her opinion. I'll ring you later with an update and we can discuss it."
He paused. "Second thoughts, I had promised to take Laura and Sam out tonight for something to eat, bit of a celebration, even if it's not the most appropriate of times. Why don't you and Gary drive over to Greenborough and join us? A Greenborough restaurant will be a damn sight safer than any of Sultan's at the moment." Marie asked where they should meet them. "D.I. Nicky Galina recommended an Italian place close to the market. It's called Mario's. Do you know it?"
"I'll find it. You know me, boss. I can sniff out food at 500 paces. What's the celebration anyway?"
"Tell you when we see you." Jackman entered the call and hastened to his car. He couldn't wait to get Laura and Sam's opinions on his theory. A&E was still very busy when he arrived at the hospital. Through the crowds of waiting patients, he glimpsed Laura, talking to one of the hospital psychologists. He made his way over to her.
"Kevin is just being discharged. His mother and father are taking him home with them for a couple of days, after which his partner Alan has arranged to take some leave. He'll move in for a while to keep an eye on him."
She gave Jackman a relieved smile.
"He'll survive. He just needs some time away from the job. I volunteered to keep some regular slots free for him. Talking it through will be a big part of his recovery."
"As long as nothing else happens." Jackman had not wanted to sound so negative, but the words had slipped out. So far, no one had come up with a plausible reason for Ashcroft selecting Kevin as a witness to the various horrors he'd devised, and Jackman had an awful feeling that he wasn't finished with him yet.
"We can't allow ourselves to think like that," Laura said, in gentle reproof. "Being on sick leave will get him away from the sharp end for a while. I've suggested that he and Alan go away for a few days, maybe get some sea air. I can't see Ashcroft traipsing around the country after him, can you?"
He couldn't. Ashcroft was far too busy in Sultan to go trotting off to the seaside.
"You're right, but I can't help worrying about him. He came too close to a complete breakdown this time, and I'd hate to see such a promising young man leave the force because of that twisted bastard Ashcroft."
He took her arm and led her to a quiet corner where several wheelchairs were parked. "I badly need to talk to you and Sam about a new development regarding Ashcroft, and I hope you don't mind, but I've asked Marie and Gary to join us at Mario's." Laura smiled.
"That's wonderful. I haven't had a chance to chat to Marie for ages."
She hesitated.
"You haven't changed your mind, have you? About us?"
Jackman kissed her cheek.
No, Laura Archer, I have not. Now, I'd like to speak to Kevin before he leaves. Then we'll find Sam and get over to the restaurant.
Laura went to fetch Sam. Jackman found Kevin sitting alone in a cubicle.
Sir, it's really kind of you to come back. I feel much better now, just really shaky.
I'm glad to hear that, Kevin. I came to see you because I don't want you to worry about your transfer to CID. After you've had a break and feel strong enough to jump back in the deep end, your new job will be waiting for you. Just don't rush it. You will have to be assessed anyway, so chill for a while. He grinned. And take advantage of Laura's offer. She's a damn good psychologist, apart from being a great human being. She will help you.
I know, sir, and I promise to see her regularly.
Kevin hesitated.
I do realise that this will take a lot of getting over. It's bound to have an effect.
Good man. A nurse carrying a clipboard came bustling into the cubicle. Time I went, Kevin. You take care, okay? The difference that just a couple of hours had made was remarkable. Kevin Stoner would make it back to the force. He'd be a changed man, certainly, but that wouldn't stop him being a fine detective. Jackman saw Laura waving to him from the far end of the emergency ward, where she stood waiting with Sam. He took a deep breath.
It was going to be a momentous evening.
My life's partner. His heart skipped a beat. He still couldn't quite believe that she was prepared to share her life with him. Him. With all his flaws, his failings. It seemed too good to be true. Yet it was real.
Ready?
Laura asked.
Ready.
In the static caravan that he shared with Jacob, Noah was busy carving a piece of wood. Supposed to be a heron, it wasn't coming out right. He wasn't concentrating, that was the problem. Jacob was playing patience and talking softly to himself. Noah was tempted to ask him the reason for his sudden change of heart regarding their eldest brother, Levi, but he decided to leave well alone. It was a mystery what went on in Jacob's head.
I wonder where Paul went, Jacob said suddenly. I mean, I know he's looking for that man, but where?
Noah shrugged.
Who knows? He could be anywhere.
Why did he make us do all those things, Noah? Why did he lie? That posh man really loved that horse of his. That's a bad thing to do. Taking something someone loves.
Will we go to hell, Noah?
Ma says no. We were just gullible, whatever that means. Anyhow, it weren't our fault. Some people are just bad, Jacob. I hope they catch him and lock him up where he can't hurt people anymore.
Noah felt his anger rising again. He hated being made a fool of.
Well, I hope Paul finds him, don't you?
Jacob shuffled his cards, then began building little card houses out of them.
He could get in very serious trouble if he does. I mean, if he hurts him, he frowned. Then Ma would be all upset and angry again.
Jacob pulled a face.
Oh, that's not good at all.
No, it's not.
Jacob suddenly looked like a small boy.
Noah, I didn't tell Ma everything. Should I?
Noah turned cold.
Depends what it was. Tell me, then we'll decide afterwards.
Should I tell her about the gun Paul had with him?
Noah closed his eyes.
Oh, shit. His air rifle, you mean?
No, it was a little gun.
Jacob pointed two fingers at his brother.
Bang, bang.
Where did he get a gun like that from?
Jacob flinched.
Don't yell at me. I don't know.
Sorry. Sorry, I'm just frightened. It's just, I never knew Paul had one of those.
Noah stood up and began to pace.
So, what about telling Ma?
Let me think, okay?
Noah didn't know what to do. It seemed to him that whatever he did, his mother would be livid. What did she used to say? Something about rocks and hard places? He came to a sudden decision.
Nowhere?
Jacob was staring at him expectantly. We have to tell her. She'll never forgive us if we don't. Noah opened the door.
Come on.
Slowly, reluctantly, Jacob followed him. Noah recalled another of his mother's expressions. A lamb to the slaughter. He knew what that one meant, all right. Chapter 27. The meal had been a good idea. While his friends relaxed, Jackman decided to get the work stuff out of the way before explaining the reason for this sudden celebration. Both Laura and Sam agreed there was a strong possibility that Ashcroft was following the pattern of many serial killers and was beginning to alter and refine his MO to accommodate new circumstances.
His original crusade, aimed at making those poor people pay for what he saw as their transgressions, is done with, Sam said. Now, he simply wants revenge. The compulsion to kill is just as strong, and he still uses the same kind of signature that he used before, the photos and messages, but he no longer has to match the punishment to the crime.
Laura added, he has chosen a different method, assassination using a gun, and has adopted a different persona. He's no longer the avenging dark angel. He's a hunter. And you, Jackman, and you, Marie, are the prey.
And all the others are collateral damage as far as he's concerned, Jackman nodded thoughtfully, including an entire town that he's reduced to a state of abject terror.
He's probably loving it, the bastard, muttered Marie.
Without a doubt, said Sam. Serial killers crave attention.
He must have been planning it for a long time, Laura said, ever since you foiled his previous activities.
The patient man, Jackman sighed.
Everyone was quiet for a while. Then Gary said, how will the fact that we've brought a halt to his game with the Lorimers and are now watching his precious church affect him? He doesn't know yet for certain that we have pinpointed the very church he uses, but he might well have his suspicions. He seems to spend a lot of time looking at us through a camera lens, so he could even have seen us checking out the different churches, said Marie. He's very clever, Laura said, so he will probably have factored that possibility into his plans.
Over to Plan B, said Sam, unfolding his serviette and placing it across his lap.
Jackman poured everyone a glass of water.
It should have been champagne tonight, but they all needed to keep their heads clear.
As he replaced the bottle on the table, his phone rang. Bugger, said Marie. What now?
They watched his face as he listened to the duty sergeant. He ended the call and turned to them.
Shots were fired in Salton a short while ago. Uniform and tactical firearms units were close by.
Marie groaned. And?
All under control.
It seems a group of gang members from the Carborough estate here in Greenborough went hunting for a rival drug dealer. Things went pear-shaped and some little scroat pulled the gun, but they hadn't taken into consideration the huge numbers of police on the streets. No one hurt, three thugs banged up and a drug dealer's address raided. Pretty good collar, I'd say.
The relief on everyone's faces was almost comical. Before anyone could speak, two waitresses arrived carrying steaming plates of food. Jackman sniffed the aroma appreciatively. This was just what they needed right now. When everyone had their respective dishes in front of them, Marie turned to Jackman.
Okay, boss, you've made us wait half the bloody evening. Now, cough.
What's this all about? What are we celebrating?
Jackman grinned, glanced at Laura, and said,
Laura has agreed to move in with me permanently. We're now partners, officially.
As he told them, he looked quickly around the group and saw nothing but delight on their faces. No one warned them to be careful. No one said they should wait. They were all united in their determination not to allow Ashcroft to blight their lives and their expectations for the future.
Best thing I've heard in ages, Gary said, beaming. I'll second that.
Marie reached across the table and squeezed Laura's hand.
I'm so happy for you.
For a moment, Jackman's sadness for Marie and her lost love came over him again. He felt quite guilty, being so happy with Laura when Marie was still alone.
Gary was a great lodger and an enormous help, but he was no life partner. Shaking off the feeling, he said,
"Tell them about our plans for the mill, Laura."
"Oh, yes. The builders have already done a brilliant job making it safe, and it's all plumbed in, wired up. The ground floor will make a fantastic consultation room."
They chatted on, relaxing for the first time in ages. Jackman watched his friends enjoy themselves. For a precious couple of hours, it was as if Ashcroft didn't exist. Then someone splashed a drop of tomato pasta sauce on the tablecloth. Scarlet on white. Marie's white blouse and the spreading blood stain. All the horror of the nightmare came flooding back. It was as if Ashcroft himself had walked into the restaurant, a warning to never, ever let his guard down. Laura took his hand and gave it a reassuring squeeze. Only she had noticed. He whispered,
"Sorry."
She smiled rather anxiously, then steered the conversation to the important topic of what to have for dessert. Not long afterwards, they were ready to leave. It would be another early start tomorrow. Jackman paid the bill. It was a pity that he and Laura couldn't drive home together, but they had each brought their own car. They said their good nights.
"I'm in the hospital car park," said Laura. "And so is Sam. It's only a 5-minute walk away. You get back to Mill Corner and Sam will walk me to my car, won't you, Sam?"
Sam nodded.
"My pleasure. And listen, everyone, as soon as this is over, you must all come to mine for dinner. And get a taxi because there will be champagne in the fridge. This wonderful news needs a follow-up party."
"Sounds great," said Marie, echoed by Gary.
Jackman beamed at Laura.
"It's a date. How about you..."
A loud crack ripped through the night and Sam Page collapsed.
"Get down!"
Jackman screamed. They threw themselves onto the pavement and rolled into the shelter of a row of parked cars. Jackman crawled over to Sam, pulled him into the cover of a shop doorway and did a swift evaluation.
"Marie, ambulance!"
"Sam!"
Laura crawled into the doorway and sank down next to her dear friend.
"Oh, Sam!"
Tears ran down her cheeks. Jackman held both hands over Sam's wound and pressed hard. The blood seeped through his fingers, but Sam was alive. Already he was beginning to wonder about Ashcroft's game. After all, thus far, he had always been fatally accurate every time. So why just wound Sam?
"Ambulance on its way!" shouted Marie.
"Okay, just stay where you are, you two. Sam might not have been the prime target. He's hurt, but he's alive."
Jackman continued to do his best for Sam, willing the twos and blues to get there fast. Sam didn't have age on his side. Jackman remembered Laura telling him that he'd had some kind of heart problem, and from the amount of blood, Jackman was pretty sure that the bullet had damaged a major blood vessel. They needed help or they'd lose him. Laura was devastated. Jackman had always known how fond she was of her old mentor, but she was reacting as if it was her own father lying wounded on the ground. But of course, Sam Page was a father figure to her. She'd lost her dad at a very young